Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, with you every Saturday afternoon on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. This weekend, Bulldog Baseball took me to San Jose, and there are a lot of World War II veterans in the San Jose area, a lot that you've told me about over the years through listening to the program and giving me some feedback, and I'm privileged to catch up with Al Tortolano today. Al was a member of what you might recognize as the Lost Battalion, so famously rescued by the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. You've heard from 442nd veterans on this show before, but we've never heard from someone from that Lost Battalion, and we're going to get that story from Al today. But Al, let's start a little earlier than that. You grew up, obviously by your last name, in an Italian-American family in Lawrence, Massachusetts. What do you remember about December 7th, 1941? How did you hear about the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor?
Well, in those days, we used to hang out, a group of us would hang out together, you know, go dancing and everything. And on Sunday mornings, we always used to get together. We liked to have a drink now and then. We had blue laws there. You couldn't drink before 1 o'clock. But we had these neighborhood stores, and they would let us hang out in the back room and have a beer or something. And that's what we do every Sunday morning, and that's what we heard about Pearl Harbor.
Was that a big shock to you? How did you process that news?
It was a shock, but we weren't expecting anything like that. You know, all we were interested at the time was going to work, make a living, and go dancing and enjoy ourselves, you know. At the time, we didn't think that that would affect us at all. You know, what's going to happen? Let's wait and see what's going to happen. And it was like confusing. You didn't know what to think.
Well, I bet it probably wasn't too long until it did affect you. When did Uncle Sam get a hold of you?
I was drafted. I didn't join. I was drafted, and I went into the service in November of 1942.
When you say that, it makes me think, you know, and people today, we don't have the draft anymore, so I think a lot of people don't understand what that was like. But I'm sure you had plans, you had aspirations, you probably had some idea of what you wanted to do, and this had to be a big change for you to be drafted.
Oh, it was. Because, at the time, like I said, I was still single. We were still enjoying going out, dancing, and stuff like that. And I didn't have what you would call a steady girlfriend or anything. You know, it was confusing to us. We didn't know what to think. What's going to happen? We used to talk amongst ourselves and say, well, what do you say? Should we join or shall we join? And this. But most of us decided, no, let's wait it out and see what happens. And then we heard about the draft, you know, the conscription. And
so you're 21 years old at that time, and the reason a lot of people did enlist is because they wanted to choose the kind of duty that they wanted. And a lot of times when you did end up getting drafted, you ended up in an infantry unit.
Right.
And that's what happened to you, right?
That's what happened to me. You had no choice. You got drafted, you reported. Most of us did wind up in the infantry.
And what was that experience like for you to be drafted, to go and get broken in, to become an Army man? Was that tough for you? Did it make you grow up in a hurry? What was it like?
Oh, yeah, it was hard because we were independent. You know, my parents were fairly strict, but, I mean, they were lenient too. I didn't know what to expect, but once I got into the service and I went to basic training, boy, I says, I don't know, am I going to make it? I was the type that didn't like being ordered around, you know. Because at home, my parents were strict, but they used to ask us to do things. They never really demanded. What a rude awakening when we get in and found out that some guy was a master sergeant, you know. You had to treat him like he was King Albert or something, you know. And it was a shock. It was. And I think the first month in basic training, I thought either they were going to kick me out or I was going to quit. But, you know, you got to meet other people. They were in the same shoes we were in. And we finally decided, hey, this is it. There's no going back. So you might as well make the best of it.
You know, when I hear you say that they were either going to kick you out or you were going to quit, it makes me think maybe you got in trouble a time or two. Any memorable instances where you had to learn something the hard way?
Well, yeah, a couple of times. Coming in late off a leave, you know, you're out there enjoying yourself and you forget about what the time and stuff and get in an hour late and you're in trouble. No excuses. Unless you died, there's no excuse as to why you were late. So, and you through extra duties and stuff like that, you know.
And I'm sure from the moment that you were drafted, you knew that eventually combat would be coming. Is that something that you were, I don't know if I want to say dreading, but something that you were not looking forward to? Or after a while, were you kind of anticipating actually getting into some action and doing some of the things that they drafted you for?
No, I don't know what I really thought because, you know, I had never seen heard anything about like that or people that were in combat. I was apprehensive, naturally. I knew that if you're in combat, there's a chance that you could be injured or killed, and it wasn't something that you looked forward to, you know. You used to think, what will I do in certain situations? And there's no way you can think ahead of time of what you're going to do. When it happens, you know. And we're just hoping that, in fact, I used to hope, against hope, that hey, by the time I get overseas, maybe things will be over, you know. But that wasn't so.
In an infantry division, there are all kinds of different jobs that different soldiers have. What was your training, and what were the duties that you were expected to carry out?
We were riflemen. All our training was in how to use a rifle with a bayonet, how to more or less try to protect yourself, and what you're supposed to do in combat, you know, things like that. Stuff that I'd never dreamed I'd be doing. I did. We had 3-month basic training, and by the second month, I was getting to the point where I said, well, I'm in it. This is it. Make the best of it. And I started trying to get along with the sergeants and stuff, you know, because they like, we had one sergeant, and he always used to tell us, listen, my word is the law. He says, when I tell you to jump, all I want you to say is how high. In other words, he says, I am your master. And that's the way it was in basic training.
Tell me about when you shipped out, when you knew you were heading across the ocean, that you were going to where the war was and that you were going to get into combat. What was that journey across the Atlantic like for you? And what do you remember thinking at the time?
After our basic training, we were promised a 30-day leave at home. Well, as luck would have it, when we got through our basic training, we went to Camp Edwards in Massachusetts, and the 36th Division was there, and they were getting ready to go overseas. So we, as recruits, were attached to the 36th Division. We got there, and we were put on curfew. We couldn't leave the area. Now here I am, 30 or so miles from home, after 3 months, hadn't seen my family. And they said, there's no way, no passes. We're getting ready to go overseas. We're going to get you ready to go overseas. I said to myself, I'm not going over without seeing my family. So I took off, went and saw my family. And I get back a day late. They said, well, there's not much we can do to you now. I said, but when we get overseas, we'll take care of it. And sure enough, I must have dug every ditch. There was a ditch when we took our training, invasion training in North Africa, but I was glad. I said if I'd never come back, at least I saw my family once again.
So you were AWOL for a while.
I was AWOL for about 30 hours.
But it was absolutely worth it as far as you're concerned.
Oh, yes, yes. Because I thought, well, going over, what are they going to do to me, you know? They're not going to tell me, well, you're not going to go overseas. You've been a bad boy. So I said, well, I'm going to take my chance, and I took my chances, and it worked out.
Would you say it was a tearful goodbye for you when you said goodbye to your folks and knew you were shipping out?
Yeah, it was, because we very close-knit family. Italians, well, most people were, but the Italians were, especially those that came from the old country, you know, we more or less lived like the way they did in Italy. We were so close. What one did affected the other. And we were three boys, so we My parents had to worry about three of us. We all three went in the service.
Do you remember anything that was said to you at that point? Was there something maybe that your mother or father said that stuck with you as you did go overseas?
My father told me that there's a good chance you may go to Italy. And he says, just be the best man you can. Do what you're told. You know, do what you have to do to survive. And just remember, he says, you're no better than the next person, but the next person is no better than you. He says, so you treat everybody the way you want to be treated. And that's what I did.
So you went to North Africa. I imagine that was a different world for you. What? How did that part of the world greet you, and what do you remember about that experience landing there?
It was a different culture altogether. At the time, we didn't have too much time to commingle with the natives there, you know, because we were doing, at first we did guarding prisoners, and then we started taking invasion training and stuff like that. But when we did get a chance to go into a town or a village or something, things are so different, you know, from what we're used to. And I hate to say it, but in Africa, they weren't the cleanest people in the world, you know. And we weren't used to living like that. Well, I know I used to try to be careful of anything I bought or ate at the civilian cities. It was a different culture altogether. And it's, like I said, though, we were kept so busy between guarding soldiers and taking infantry training that we didn't have too much time to either get in trouble or, you know, think too much about the outside world. So
it wasn't like Casablanca for you. Little different experience in North Africa than Humphrey Bogart had.
Oh yeah, it was. And I thought at the time when you get caught out at night, if you're in town and going back to your outfit, you have to be careful because those people there would strip you for anything you had they'd take. So we used to make sure that whenever we went to town, we were always in a group, three or four people, and tried never to get separated. So
sounds like you were growing up in a hurry.
Oh yes. Yes, we learned. It was so different than what we were used to in growing up, you know, in Massachusetts, in the area that we lived in. I mean, everyone knew everyone. You never locked your doors. You could leave your keys in the car if you owned one, and it would be there the next day, you know. So We learned a lot of things fast, and we grew up fast, too.
We're talking to Al Tortolano, who served in the 36th Infantry Division in World War II. He lives now in San Jose, California, and we'll have much more of his story. He talked about training to invade Italy. When we come back, we're going to hear about that actual process. And before the program's over today, we'll hear about the two Purple Hearts, the two Bronze Stars, and of course, that famous rescue of his lost battalion by the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. Al Tortolano of San Jose, our guest today. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. My guest today, Al Tortolano of San Jose, California. He's 89 years old. He served in the 36th Infantry Division in World War II. And when he left off, he had told us about going over to North Africa. There, the troops trained for the eventual invasion. Of course, you know that the invasion of most of the European continent didn't start until 1944, but in terms of Italy, it started much earlier. So you talked about training for an invasion, Al, and I'm sure as time went by, you probably were starting to wonder, when are we actually going to go over? When are we going to do something here? How did that unfold for you?
Well, finally, we got on the ships to go on the invasion, and it was then we were told where we were going. So we were told that we were going to make an invasion in Italy. And boy, did that hit me. Because I figured, here I am, I'm going to a country where we still have relatives there. And I worried about maybe either getting killed or killing one of my own, you know, a relative. And we were going to make the landing September 9th. Lo and behold, it was like something out of heaven. On September 8th, over the loudspeakers on the ship, it said the Italians have capitulated. Says so when they are not going to fight you. So when we get to where we're going, if you have anything to do with it, you know, Italian soldiers, they are going to give themselves up. And man, if you don't know how happy that made me, knowing that, you know, we're not having to fight our own people, you know. It was September 9th when we hit the beaches of Salerno. And I was on the first wave and the first scout because of being able to speak Italian. They felt that maybe, you know, if we, after hitting the beaches, if we did get any contact with any Italians, I could ask them different questions, you know.
And I bet you did come in contact. And I'm sure when you were a boy growing up and your grandmother was speaking Italian to you, you didn't think it was going to come in that handy, but I bet it came in real handy then.
Oh, it did. Because I'll tell you, when we hit the beaches, we were really hit pretty bad. And I think the first, second, and third waves were, you know, foot troops get in. And then after that, they were shelling the ships out there so bad that they couldn't get the heavy equipment in. And for about on the third or fourth day, they asked if we could get pulled back because, you know, we were getting slaughtered there. And they said, no, there's no way we can get you off the beach. There's no way we can get help. You're just going to have to wing it, you know. But about on the fourth, I think it was the fourth day, they started getting the heavy equipment in and things started turning around.
Well, you talked about what a load it had been off your shoulders when you heard that the Italians had capitulated and you're expecting to not face much opposition. So how big of a jolt was it for you when you're wading ashore and bullets are flying? Was that unnerving? How would you describe that?
Oh, of course it was unnerving. We didn't know what to do. Here, you know, we didn't know what to expect. There was no way in the world they could prepare us for what we were going to find, you know. And here you're hearing bullets whizzing by and mortars coming in, and you're seeing friends being injured or killed. And, you know, right away you say, what did I get myself into, you know? Now what do I do? And it's almost like trying to second guess everybody because you didn't know where things were coming from, and it got to the point where all of a sudden you don't know where your sergeant is, you don't know where some of your lieutenants are, and it's almost like now you're on your own, you know. Here you are fighting a battle and you're not sure exactly what you're supposed to do, and that's the first few days. But then we started getting together again, and things started looking up a little.
Sounds like those were some pretty long days for you that you thought maybe you wouldn't make it through. But obviously, you're sitting here with me, you did. And so once you got some of the equipment on shore, how did things progress from there?
Well, things went pretty good after that. We didn't advance too fast or too far. But when we got all the equipment, the tanks and stuff came in, we started making some progress. We started working our way up from Salerno on up through Naples and stuff. We had some real weird battles, though, even before we got to France. That was something we found out after. Even our officers were told there was no way in the world we could cross the river at the point they wanted us to cross. But I think it was General Dalquist, one of the generals anyway, insisted that we were going to cross the Rapido River. Three attempts we made, and we never did get across. I was on the second wave. I never made it across. And we were in these big rubber raft boats, like, but that river was so swift. We got, like, on the one I was on, we got about three-quarters of the way across, and the rope that was attached, because there were some on the other side, the rope that we were attached let loose, and our raft was drifted way down, and we were lucky that we landed on our own side. But I felt so bad for those that did make it across. They were either all captured or killed.
So there's where it's a good thing you didn't make it across, and And you could have told the general, if you just translated the Italian toward him, you would have told him what that river meant and that the current was too fast to cross, huh?
See, and the Rapido River was a narrow river. It wasn't very wide. But what we didn't know, north of us, there was a dam. And when we started making our crossing, they opened the floodgate to the dam, and that water came rushing down. It was really... See, and the area where they wanted us to make a crossing was it like a cove, so that the Germans were on the other side, and they had us crossfired. There was crossfire. And before we even made the attempt on our side, before the Germans pulled over to the other side, they knocked down all the trees and everything in the area, so we were wide open. Everything was wide open. We were sitting ducks.
So obviously you saw a lot of your friends, a lot of your buddies, either killed or wounded in that action. And how did you take that? How do you handle a situation like that?
I don't know. You don't. When I found out, I mean, we lost almost the whole company. When I found that out, I said, my God, how did I make it? You know, and why me? And not, you know, I'm still here. And a lot of those guys that I came over with... They're gone. And we were in so many battles and we hit so hard. I don't know how much of a turnover we've had in our outfit.
Well, and it seems to me that there's two extremes of how you can deal with a situation like that. Some guys might say, it's happening to everybody around me, so eventually my turn is going to come and I'm going to have the same fate they had. Or some guys say, you know what? Somebody's looking out for me. There's something more for me that I need to do. Where do you think on that spectrum, where do you think your approach fit in?
I think I was at that point where I think I'm going to be one of the lucky ones, because from Salerno up to the Rapido River and everything, we had quite a few skirmishes, and I made out okay. I was sent out on a couple of patrols because I spoke Italian. I was sent out on a couple of patrols and hoping to make contact with some Italian civilians, you know, and find out what was going on in the area. And I said, I'm living through this. I'm one of the lucky guys, saying I hope that my luck holds out. And yet you turn around and say, why? Why am I still here when these others, because we're all in the same area. We're all doing the same thing. We're all taking the same crap. And yet I'm still here and they're not, you know.
Well, I still need to get from you the story of your two Purple Hearts, your two Bronze Stars, and, of course, that Lost Battalion. So we'll take our break here, and when we come back, we'll get all the rest of Al Tortolano's World War II story. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Al Tortolano, 89 years old, of San Jose, my guest today. I promise we get the story of those decorations that he's received, the Purple Heart times two, same for the Bronze Star. And we're going to backtrack a little bit, because that first Bronze Star citation occurred pretty early after you guys had invaded. I guess about 5 days into the battle there, you did something that earned you the Bronze Star. Tell me how that happened.
Well, I did it then, but I didn't get the Bronze Star till... later, you know, you don't get it till way later.
And you probably wondered if you've ever get it for a while, but go ahead.
Yeah. Well, what happened, my captain was sending out a patrol to see if we could make contact with some Italians. And rather than send out a patrol, they said, well, Private Tortolano says, we'd like to send you out, see if you can make contact with a civilian in the area of Altaville. And I did. I went out, and I was like a one-man squad. And I went up, and I got to the village, and I made contact with one of the Italian there. And I never asked him his name. I never told him my name. That was one of the things they told me not to do. And... through him, we found out that they had, up in the church steeple, they had Germans were up in there, and they could see everything that was going on down below. And we thought, well, that's where they're, you know, things are happening. So while being with him, I was coming back. He was going to show me, you know, how to get back and that. But we ran into a little trouble. We heard Germans, we heard noises, and we found out that there were some Germans in the area. So he told me that he was going to go back to his village and for me to find my way back to my company, and which I did.
All by yourself. You're all alone, and there are Germans in the area, and you have every chance in the world of getting killed.
Right. But luckily, they weren't that close, and they weren't looking for anybody. It's just that they were there, you know. But anyway, I got back, and Captain Harmonson, that was his name. I told him what was going on, what I had found out, and I think it helped because they started firing artillery at the church. And they either might have knocked it out or scared them out of there or something. But the next day, we weren't getting hit like we were before.
So that was some valuable information that you presented that may have saved some lives and certainly helped your advance.
Oh, yeah. And I think that's why Captain Harmonson put my name in.
So that was the first Bronze Star you earned. And I understand you were also wounded once before the whole Lost Battalion incident. What happened there?
Okay, that's, we had come off a battle, and we got pulled back for a rest. After about 3 days, we found that there were some of our men were wounded up on this hill, and they asked for volunteers to go up and get them out, you know, it's like stretcher bear, litter bearers. So we went up there, and we were told to follow these cables, communication lines, then that would take us to the area where the wounded were. Well, somehow we followed the lines, but they took us on the wrong side of the hill. The wounded were on this side of the hill, we're on the other. And the Germans are on another hill looking right down our throats. And we started getting mortar fire. And there were six of us walking in a line. And a mortar hit right close by. And the guy behind me, two guys away from me, one of them got killed. The lead man got killed. I must have been blown up. Off about 3 or 4 feet off the ground, and so I became one of the guys that had to be carried off the hill. And I don't know how I made it, because when I got to the aid station where they took care of us, when they showed me the blanket that I had under my arm that we were going to use to cover the wounded with, they opened it up. It was loaded full of holes with shrapnel. So I got shrapnel there. I had some shrapnel here and a couple of pieces in my throat.
So in your midsection and your throat all over the place, and you had to be in pain and wondering if you're going to make it.
Well, I didn't know. They say I was out for 3 days. So I really didn't know anything until I came to in the on a third day, but they said everything was okay, except for the concussion and stuff. They said I was all right, so they kept me another day. I think I was there altogether 5 days, and then they said that I was well enough to go back to my outfit.
But from the moment that shell hit to you coming to in the aid station, 3 days worth of life, you don't remember anything between that time?
Nope. I don't know what happened while I was there.
And they said you were fine to go back to the Lions. Did you feel like you were ready to go back to the Lions?
No, but I knew I had to go back. And the funny part, well, they were going to put me in the nearest outfit. And I said, no way. I said, I'm going, I want to go back to my own outfit. Because even though we kept losing men, there were still, you know, guys that I knew. And I didn't want to go in with a group of strangers. So I found my own way back to where the 36th Division was.
And I'm sure eventually you wondered if that was the right thing to do once the whole Lost Battalion incident unfolded. Tell me about that. For those who aren't familiar with it, where were you guys, and how did you become, as they say now, lost and abandoned?
Okay, that was in the Bosage Mountains up around Bruyères. Mm-hmm. And our objective was up in to take this hill and capture this hill, because it would be a strategic hill to look down on the Germans on the other side. Now, it was tough going to get there because there was no road, no nothing up there, and we had to more or less go up like in a column of ones. And going up, it seemed it wasn't bad. We had hardly any resistance, and we thought, wow, this is a piece of cake. You know, and we got up there, and we practically hardly any fighting at all. But then, all of a sudden, we get up there, and we're overnight. The next morning, we're wondering, well, how come there's nobody coming up, you know?
Reinforcements or anyone to help you?
Yeah, and come to find out, Germans let us get up there, and then they cut right down in back of us and cut us off. And I don't think we didn't know it for at least almost a day and a half that we were cut off, and we didn't know what the heck we were going to do. So they sent out I think it was about a 25-man patrol. And then we didn't find out till later that they didn't get through, and we don't know what happened to them, whether they captured, killed, or what, but they didn't get through. We couldn't figure out what the heck we were going to do. We had a radio man, this Irwin Blonder. He's living in Florida now, and I got to meet him after the war. But he was our radio man, and he radioed, used the radio to tell them that, hey, we're in dire need of food, ammunition, and stuff like that, because we were, like I said, we were cut off. They couldn't get anybody to us. They couldn't get anything to us. And it got to the point where we pooled our resources. On the third day, whatever we had, little food we had, we pulled the ammunition, and we were allotted so much stuff a day, you know.
So were you personally aware of how dire this situation was, and that at that point it was most likely you were either going to be killed or captured?
Yeah. On the fourth day, we knew for sure that because we got a little, like I said, this Irwin Blonder, he got word that they had tried, 2nd Battalion had tried getting us out, and they couldn't do it. And the American, whatever American troops they sent in, they got beat back. They just couldn't break through. And so it got to the point that I think it was on the fifth day when Irwin Blonder and his Captain Martin, I think his name was, he was in charge. And they were, from what I found out from Blonder after, it was almost like flipping a coin. So, do we give up, or do we, you know, stay and try to fight it out. And their decision was, we're gonna fight it and see, you know, what happens. And as things turned out, on the seventh day, they got the 442nd to come in, and they lost a lot of men to get. We were about 220 of us, and they lost, oh, I don't know how many men wounded and captured and stuff to get through to us. But they finally got through to us on the seventh day.
I'm curious, you talk about the captain deciding whether or not to surrender. Have you ever wondered how your life would have been different if they had surrendered? And you think you'd still be here if they had surrendered and you guys would have become prisoners of war?
No, I don't know if the rumors were true or not, but from what we gathered, you didn't want to be a prisoner. You know, we thought, you know, how are you going to be treated? And if you got to the point where we lost the war, what would happen to us, you know, as prisoners of Germany? You know, it was just something that, you know, and after we even talked about it, says, hey, if it was like a thing where, okay, let's take a vote, I think that most of us would have voted to fight, you know, fight or be captured or killed or whatever. But I think giving up was never an option.
Before I ask you about the 442nd and how indebted you feel to those guys, just tell me what it was like when you realized that someone had broken through, that you guys had a chance of being rescued. What were those moments like, and what kind of feeling was that for you?
Oh, I don't know. It was almost like being reborn, I think, because you don't know what to think. You know, while you're there and the way things are going, your mind is first on your family. You know, will I ever see them again? What will happen? How will they take it? You know, knowing that I'm never gonna come back. And it was just, I don't know, the feeling that we had. But then when we found out that they finally broke through, oh man, it was like the sun coming out after a storm, you know. Because you figure it was 7 days of what we went through. And it was really hell up there, because we couldn't really dig in deep because it was mountain, you know, and there was a lot of rock and stuff. You couldn't really dig a foxhole. And even if you did, the tree bursts, you had to worry about tree bursts, you know. When all of a sudden, we heard one guy say, oh my God, we're fighting the Japs. Because we didn't even know at the time that there was a 442nd. Mm-hmm. And yet they were attached to our division at times. Mm-hmm. But we didn't even know. And that's why that's one guy that made that remark when we saw Japanese soldiers who were fighting the Japs. But then we found out there are rescuers, and all we wanted to do was get out of there. And so we took off. I mean, we didn't stop to say thank you then or anything. All we wanted to do was get our butts off that mountain, and off we went.
And I'm sure it wasn't until later that you realized the severe losses that they absorbed. They lost more men than they saved in terms of rescuing you. When you figured that out, how did that weigh on you? How did you process that, knowing that many men had sacrificed their lives for yours?
When I finally got to the, you know, thinking about it, I know when they first rescued us, I was so happy and thankful. And then when we found out years, we didn't know until way later how many they actually lost. And I thought about it, I felt so bad. Because I said, here's a group of people that were used during the war I don't know how to put it, but it seemed like when any dirty job had to be done or any fighting that they feel was almost impossible, the 442nd was always involved. And then I find out what their parents went through. And for them to volunteer to fight for their country like they did, I don't know if it's, I didn't know how to think about it. It's something you figure, man, I just grab them and want to hug them, you know, and show them how you really felt about them.
And for folks who aren't familiar with the 442nd, the Go for Broke unit, and Al just described how they were Go for Broke. They were given the tough jobs. They were Japanese Americans, many of whom had families in internment camps. Their families were being held hostage, basically, by the American government at the very time they were risking their lives, and in this case, giving their lives to save other Americans. And you talk about wanting to hug them. I'm sure you've had the opportunity to meet some of the soldiers from the 442nd. What is that like for you? And is there anything that needs to be said? Is it a look in your eye, a hug, a pat on the back, or have you had a chance to actually speak to them how much you appreciated them saving your life?
Oh, yes, I sure did. For about 8 years, I've been a volunteer up at the VA hospital in Palo Alto. Well, one day I'm driving the little shuttle around, and this Japanese-American, Lawson Sakai, says, "Are you Al Tortolano?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, I'm Lawson Sakai." He says, "Somebody told me that you were driving." He said, "I'm with the," he said, "I was with the 442nd. "Oh, my God." He says, "Is there any chance we can get together and talk?" I says, "Oh, yeah, yeah." So anyway, we started talking. And he said, "You know," he says, "we have another guy that's a patient here that was a 442nd rescuer too." So he took me up to the room and introduced me to this other guy, and that's how I started getting involved with the 442nd. So from there, they started inviting me to their different functions. I went to their reunions in Las Vegas as their guest, you know. They made me an honorary member of the 442nd, and we got to swap stories, and I got to meet so many wonderful people, and I still now keep in touch. Lawson Sakai lives in Morgan Hill, so we keep in touch. My good buddy Mickey Akiyama, he passed away. He was up there at VA. He passed away, and we used to, every Tuesday, I would go up and visit him after I get through my shift of volunteering up there. And like I say now, I still keep in touch with them, and I've gone to a couple of their reunions.
And what does that do for you when you get a chance to talk to them and thank them? Do you feel like you're just speaking for yourself, or do you feel like you're speaking for all 220 guys who were saved by their brave actions?
Oh, no, I'm speaking for everybody. Yeah, because I know how they felt. And not only speaking for those 220, I think I'm speaking for every other soldier that was in combat over there, and thinking that, man, if every division had a 442nd, what a great thing that would be. It would have been for everybody. Every time I see one, I don't care if I saw him yesterday and I see him again today, it's like another new beginning, you know. I look at him and say, wow, this is one of the guys that the reason I'm maybe standing here today, you know. Maybe we would have gotten out of it. We never know. But as far as I'm concerned, they were our saviors. And they deserve every little hello or thank you that they can get.
And without them, you never would have met your wife, Alice. You wouldn't have this marriage of 63 years or your two children. So I guess you do owe the 4/42 quite a bit. And before we wrap up, now, I told everybody that you had two incidents where you earned the Purple Heart and two where you were recognized with the Bronze Star. So we only got half of that. When were you wounded again?
I didn't get injured or anything. It was for what I did while we were surrounded. I was like a gopher, go-between. You know, I would go talk to this guy, go talk to that guy, and I don't know. It was just, I was so scared that I think in order to really make it, that I had to do something. Mm-hmm. And there was a couple of guys like that got wounded, and I went over and helped, you know, befriended them and did what I could. I helped some of the medics. Mm-hmm. We had a couple of medics there, you know, and I don't know why I did it. But I kind of went out of my way to help them, and I guess word got back to them, and I was amazed when I got my second Bronze Star. You know, I didn't even expect it.
I've got to ask you too, after everything that you went through, and you know, from being wounded, being out for 3 days, to being in the Lost Battalion and rescued by the heroic 442nd. When you finally got to come back to America, what was that like for you? Is that a day that you thought was never going to come? And what do you remember about that?
Yes, after going through what we went through, I didn't think I would make it. But boy, when we made it and I got back, it was so, after World War II, those of us that got back, we were treated like kings. I mean, we got off in Boston. I don't think we couldn't pass a joint without somebody wanting to drag us in and buy us a drink and do something, you know. And I don't know, there were about four of us, and we just said, wow, if this the way going to be treated all the time, let's go back again, you know. We joke about it. It was so, I don't know, as long as you had your uniform on, I mean, people would come up to you, hug you, and thank you for what you did. You know, it was so, so great.
Well, I've got to ask you in closing, knowing that you continue to volunteer, like you told us, the VA in Palo Alto, why do you do that? Why is that important for you? And what do you get out of it?
Well, I know what these kids are going through right now, coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, and it breaks my heart to see what they have to go through. And I feel that just this little something, volunteering up there and driving them around from one building to another, it just makes me feel like I'm still doing my part, you know, because if you ever bump into those people, it's like a different kind of war than World War II was. These guys come back with this brain trauma and stuff. And
I imagine you're probably going to keep doing that as long as you have a driver's license, huh?
That's right. I'm going to keep doing it until I can't do it anymore. I've been very active with the disabled veterans since 1955. I was state commander, and I'm on the state executive board now. I keep real busy with them, and as long as I can do it, I'm going to do it.
Well, Al, thank you so much for serving our country, for telling me a little bit about it. Is there anything else that you'd like to share with our listeners?
No, but like you said, yep, I thank those guys again, because I got the greatest family in the world. Got the greatest wife, two children that are really great, and I owe it all to them.
Well, I'm sure the 442nd The guys are very proud and very touched to hear you say that. That's our program for today. Al Tortolano of San Jose has been our guest. If you missed part of the program, you can catch it online at kmjnow.com. And we'll be back next week with another edition of Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.